Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Business and Transportation Committee. It's March 4th, 2015. We got a number of bills up today. I think Senator Johnson is here.
Yes, sir.
There you are. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 548. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 548 authorizes county to sell or donate property to eligible Indian tribes in Oregon, declares emergency effective upon passage. There is no revenue impact, there is no fiscal impact, and there is no amendment.
Oh, wonderful bill.
This is a fine piece of public
Welcome
policy.
To the committee, Commissioner. Senator.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, which encompasses the north part of Tillamook County. And I am here simply to introduce Team Tillamook County that has issue area expertise and can speak directly to the merits of this fine bill, but I just want to commend it for your consideration. And with that, I have the privilege of introducing Mark Labhart, a Tillamook County Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator. Senators, welcome. For the record, Mark Labhart, and I have the privilege of being a Tillamook County Commissioner. I've been a County Commissioner in Tillamook County for 11 years, but I'm not representing Tillamook County today. I am today representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I sit on their legislative committee. I also sit on the board of the Association of Oregon Counties. This bill came before our legislative committee, and we approved it out of our subcommittee unanimously, took it to the full Association of Oregon County's legislative group, and we support this bill unanimously. All 36 counties are in support of Senate Bill 548, and that's all I want to say is we'll have some details presented by some folks in the back of the room, but the Association of Oregon Counties strongly endorses this bill and asks for your support.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah.
Senator Monroe.
Can you ever remember any time that all 36 counties agreed on anything?
Well, the vote was unanimous, sir.
Wonderful.
And, Mr. Chair, to the end to validate the statement, Rob Beauvais and from AOC, their legal counsel, as well as Paul Levesque, who's the county manager for Tillamook County, can explain the precise details of the bill, if you would allow them to follow us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Beauvais and whomever else needs to come with you.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Beauvais, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. Currently under Oregon law, we have a provision in state law that allows counties to transfer tax foreclosed properties to other government entities, cities, the state, the feds. It's a fairly simple statute. In my previous history as with county council in Lincoln County, we acquired some property that was logically and should be transferred to a tribe. So I had to research the statutes and look at what we have on existing law, and to say I was pounding a square peg into a round hole is an understatement. I found a way to do it, but it was clunky. It required reversionary clauses, and it just makes sense to me that tribes be in the same position as any other government entity and be able to receive transfers of county tax foreclosed properties. With that, that's exactly what this bill does. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
I don't know. That's a good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, for the record, my name is Paul Levesque. I am Chief of Staff for Tillamook County. I'm also the statewide president of the Oregon Public Property Managers Association. That's a group of managers from the Oregon counties that deal with the management and disposition of tax foreclosed property. At our November meeting, there was unanimous approval to endorse this bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Guess not. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And let's see, we have Mr. Martin and...
Oh, I was going to vote for the bill.
Mr. Levesque, is that it? Or?
I think that was just him.
No, okay. No. And Mr. Mason, you want to come up as well? All right, let's vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. And I know that you guys have heard this many, many times, but Oregon is truly unique when it comes to their relationship in working with our nine federally recognized tribes. It's something that we can all be proud of since the beginning with Governor Attia as a state senator, championing the Commission on Indian Services all the way through to certifying tribal police officers through DPSST a couple of sessions ago. We have really done great things, putting Senate Bill 770 into statute, creating the government-to-government process. We've really been able to reap a lot of rewards. We've done things like remove offensive language from Oregon geographic board names. We've done things like create reservation enterprise zones to try to get some other economic activity into our communities. And this bill specifically, which we are in such support of, brings us together with counties. And as you know, we work and live and play with those counties in rural parts of this state. So we believe that this is yet another step in that government-to-government process and one that continues to show Oregon's uniqueness and why Oregon's recognized tribes are such a fabric of this great state. So with that, please, we do support passage of Senate Bill 548. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Justin. Michael?
Chair Beyer and members of the Business and Transportation Committee, for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, who do not oppose the bill. They understand that there's value to this bill, and in terms of improving the relationship with counties, they certainly have a very positive relationship with Lincoln County, which is the bulk of their original reservation, and are very grateful to Mr. Bovet for his work on a difficult transfer of property involving a site on the Siletz River. Understand that this bill would have made that transfer easier and would make future transfers easier. The concern that the Siletz tribes have, and they'd like a little time to work on a possible amendment, is in the very case of that site, Medicine Rock. What they're afraid about it in current law, I think, as well as in this bill, is that it doesn't set any kind of limit on which tribe might be able to acquire land. That's right in the heart of their original reservation, that site. And so something that would, I think, protect from possible purchases by other tribes. I want to go back for just a minute. I don't want to take much of your time with this. But when I was at the solicitor's office for the Department of the Interior, I was handed a huge stack one day, and my boss said, here are 200 trust land requests from tribes around the country. And there had been a moratorium on taking land in trust, and that was about to end. And he said, I want you to tell me which one of these we ought to do and which ones we ought not to do. And the ones that jumped out at me, there was one where the Navajo Nation had purchased land within the Hualapai Reservation. I said, whoa, hold on. we don't need to be creating a reservation inside a reservation. So that was one that was rejected. Another one was a parcel of land that involved a tribe buying land right next to another tribe's reservation at a distance from their own. I don't remember the rest of them being rejected, but that was a situation where the BIA said, you know, we're just helping to create a problem. So anyway, that's just the idea to consider some kind of protection from something like that happening. So that's, I bring that to your attention, and we'll continue to discuss, of course, a way to solve this so the bill can move forward.
So, Michael, have you been in discussion about this with the proponents of the bill?
Only briefly, Senator. I've just recently, just last night, gotten some suggestion on what an amendment might look like from the Siletz. So
I guess the question would be, do you want to take a couple of days and work on it, or do you want to work on it on the House side?
Well, it would be good to take a couple of days to work on it. it's up, you know, obviously it's up to the committee to take whatever action you feel you need to do. But if we could have a couple of days, we'd appreciate it.
Okay.
Go ahead. Is there any overlap between the nine tribes, the land area?
Yeah, there. I mean, you could pretty safely say there's overlap among all of them.
Well, that's what.
So there are not clearly delineated lines in most instances. This is an easier thing to address east of the mountains, where you have these clear. They're not always clear, but there are treaty lines that have been drawn and upheld by the courts, Senator and Sheriff Beyer. So east of the mountains is a little easier, though southeastern Oregon is not easy on this. West side, there's a lot of overlap, and I think that's well understood that there's a lot of overlap, and I don't think an amendment that we'd propose would reduce the chances of this whatever purchase or sales Tillamook County's trying to do.
Other questions? All right. You're a little late to the game, but we'll see. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I had signed up.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, I think we'll set this one over for a couple of days and allow people to talk about it, and we'll bring it back up next week. We can get it on the agenda. All right, so we will close on Senate Bill 548, and we'll open a public hearing on 574. Is Senator Olson here?
I cannot see either of them, but I told them that we're going soon.
Okay, so we're open. Did I open on 574?
Not yet.
So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 574. James.
Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 574 directs the Construction Contractors Board to adopt rules for the issuance of residential restoration contractor license for persons providing restoration work on residential or small commercial structures following man-made or natural disaster. There is a Dash 1 amendment. It modifies effective date to January 1st, 2017. There is no fiscal impact or revenue impact on that amendment.
Senator Olson, do you want to testify on this one?
I was waiting for Senator Shields. Is he coming down?
He's supposed to be coming.
I was waiting for him.
Okay, so let's. Who else was on here? Mike, you want to go while we're waiting?
Yeah, I'm happy to.
Okay. Would you, I don't know where he is. Is he in committee? Would you call him, please? It's unusual. You get to speak before the sponsors.
Yeah, especially when you hear what
I'm saying. We're trying for efficiency here.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with Associated General Contractors. Probably not a great person to lead off on this bill, but briefly, all I will say is that we were engaged in this bill when it initiated in 2014. We had significant issues with a couple of the sections of the bill, and really I was here to just speak to the process. It was a very fair and open work group process. A lot of our concerns were alleviated to the point where, frankly, the bill doesn't much apply to most of our membership, but I was here to speak in favor of a really good process and a really good work group, and with that I'll close.
That's good. Any questions? Well, no. Let's see.
He's coming down.
I'm coming down. So we'll stand at ease for a minute.
Oh, let me go speed him up.
Sometimes government does good things.
Sometimes we're just too efficient.
The committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. Here to testify in support in Senate Bill 574. I'm chief co-sponsor of 574, which puts restoration work resulting from disaster clearly under the licensing authority of the Construction Contractors Board. And I'm happy to be joined today by my colleague, Senator Olson, who is also a chief sponsor of the bill. For those of you not familiar with the topic, restoration companies restore property damaged by flood, fire, and other unexpected, unfortunate circumstances. There are a lot of good restoration companies providing valuable services in the state. In fact, I had one on Christmas morning at 4 a.m. Provide those services to my house when a pipe broke that morning. And that company helped my family put our home back together. And this company was, as many restoration companies are, already CCB licensed. However, there are a growing number of restoration companies in this state that are flying under the radar and are preying on victims of disaster at their most vulnerable moments. My office first found out about the problem after a five-alarm district in our fire in our district when concerned constituents brought to our attention that a company solicited work from them as they watched their belongings burn to the ground. They got them to essentially sign a blank check contract and misled them about what would be covered by insurance. My staff followed up with the fire chiefs and firefighters associations to see if this was an isolated incident, and the resounding answer was no, that there are these kinds of predatory practices were an increase, and they were an increasing problem across the state. This topic may sound familiar to you because we tried to address this issue in 2014. The Senate passed Senate Bill 1571 under broad bipartisan support, which would have allowed consumers an unwaivable right to rescind a contract made under duress. During the process of that bill, many restoration companies reached out to my office to relay their support for clamping down on what they saw as new predatory companies that would listen in on scammers to chase fires and ultimately harass victims under duress. Some of these companies have submitted testimony today, and prior to a couple years ago, they said that the norm had been for the victim to call their insurance company to get connected with restoration work, or if they were uninsured, to seek out services once they had a chance to emotionally collect themselves. However, new tactics by some of these companies were now increasing in number and negatively impacting the livelihood of traditional good acting companies. Senate Bill 1571 did not pass in the House, however, because of concerns from the contracting community. And you know, we tried to come at it in a particular way, and a lot of, I think, legitimate concerns were brought up. So in response, we set up a work group with the contracting community, firefighters, and CCB to address the issue. It included Senator Olson, also included Representative Andy Olson and Representative Debbie Boone. Senate Bill 574 is the result of that work group. CCB licensure will provide needed oversight of fire restoration companies that use some of these predatory tactics on consumers. And, you know, it's not this is a compromise. We looked at about five different ways that we thought we could get at the problem, but the one thing that we all agreed on and felt like would be a good approach was licensing these companies with CCB so that if somebody had some misbehavior, that there would be somewhere for the consumer to go to potentially get their license pulled. Lastly, CCB licensure ensures that all restoration companies are bonded and insured, conform to contract language requirements aimed at protecting consumers, and participate in contract dispute resolution. I will also note that we worked with Director Deno at the CCB on a Dash 1 amendment in order to fulfill their request, which we thought was reasonable, to extend the implementation date. That we do not have the Dash 1 back yet.
We do, and the statements are there.
Great. Okay, so we're ready to roll. So then, it should be a very simple amendment, just extending out the implementation date to July 1st, I believe.
The date.
Yeah. So I would encourage you to adopt the Dash 1, move it to the floor with the due pass recommendation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alan Olson. I represent Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. Senator Shields called me in on this, and we talked about this restoration bill, and one of the concerns I had is we had restoration companies coming in, and they were doing more than just fixing up smoke damage and water damage. Some companies were going in and doing actual structural work, which concerned both the construction industry and myself, as I am a general contractor. Senator Shields' tutelage, we were able to work through this process and get everybody on the same page. I think this is an excellent bill. It will benefit those people that have catastrophe in their life. As an example, my sister, one day we got a call about 10 years ago, and my dad did, and she said, my house is on fire. And my dad called me, and he says, is your house on fire? I said, no. I said, it's not. I said, was it Lisa, my sister? And she goes, he goes, yes. And so we raced over there, and lo and behold, the house was on fire, totally engulfed. And as we stood there and watched this house burn to the ground, I physically saw at least three different groups of people go to my sister and my brother-in-law and ask if they could get involved with the cleanup. As a general contractor, I could do it. The next day, we had fence around it, and within a week, the house was totally gone because it was nothing left. So their response would have been, you know, maybe they hoped the house would have been saved or whatever. But I thought it was rather strange that in their hour of need and fear, people are in there, you know, pushing their business. And when Senator Shields had this, it just struck me as this is what we need to do. We need to have some kind of agency, which is CCB, that can help these people. And if there is a problem, CCB will be there to support them and help them get through any contractual issues that they might have obligated themselves to at an hour of tremendous terror, actually. And it really benefits it, too, because some of these companies come in and they want to do structural work. And if they're not licensed by the CCB, they can't. You know, they can fix a doorknob. They might be able to sweep out the water, such as in Senator Shields, which he didn't call me, by the way. But the fact is that when you get into working structural and working with trusses and walls and bearing walls and all this stuff, you need to have a licensed contractor, and it's good to see that we have a bill now that will help these folks. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much, Senators. Questions? Don't see any. Thanks a lot.
How easy.
Let's get back to work here. Let's see. Kate Newhall and Bob Livingston, you both want to come up?
Mr. Chair, and despite my glib response, I did want to say I really did appreciate AGC working very hard on this bill. It was I'm very appreciative of their efforts.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome to the committee. Who wants to go first?
I guess I get to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I've also had the privilege and honor for over 20 years being a firefighter as well. I think the co-chairs of this bill did an excellent job of framing it. From a firefighter perspective, I just wanted to put on the record that there are certainly good companies that do provide good services after a time of need from people. Unfortunately, there are some predatory practices that are occurring and continue to occur out there at a person's most vulnerable time. Unfortunately for us, there's limitations to what a firefighter can do. You know, primarily our job is to handle life safety, conserve property, and put fires out. So what happens is we can certainly control the scene, but we can't control who comes to a scene and what they may or may not say to an individual that is truly in no position to make good decisions. Senate Bill 574 hopefully will correct that, provide the consumer at their most dire time with some protection so that bad decisions aren't being made. I'd just like to put on the record that also that this is not a unique problem to simply Portland. You know, as I've checked with other firefighters from throughout the state, these issues arise in Eugene, certainly here in Salem and in other parts of the state. So we think this is a good bill not only to protect the people that are at the most vulnerable time perhaps in their entire life on a catastrophic event such as a fire, but it also helps us to do our job a little bit better to help protect those individuals. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we appreciate the work that the committee has done over the past year as well as the stakeholders. And with that, would be happy to take any questions.
Any questions, Bob? See any? Kate?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you. Kate Newhall, for the record, here today representing the Sheet Metal Contractor Association and the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association. We also participated in the work group that Senator Shields convened, and I think it was personally, I was sort of shocked to learn that this practice even existed when the bill came up the first time around. And we did have several work group meetings with Senator Shields. As he sort of described, we looked at several different options to find a way to address this problem, because I think everybody on the work group agreed that this was definitely a predatory practice and definitely something that needed to be addressed. So at the end of all of that, we came to Senate Bill 574 that's before you today. I think our contractors were very appreciative of Senator Shields convening the work group and allowing the sort of process to go through and find a solution that kind of worked for all of the parties involved. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? See none. Thank you both. We now have someone, Matthew Stiemel, who wants to call in. Well, I guess we'll call him. Matthew, this is Senator Lee Beyer, chairing the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. I understand you would like to testify on Senate Bill 574.
Yes, sir, I would. Thank you for the opportunity.
Please go ahead.
I have a statement, and I'm just going to go ahead and read through that, if that's okay?
That's fine.
All right, sir. My name is Matthew Steinle. I'm the sales manager for Kennedy Restoration in Portland, Oregon. By way of introduction, Kennedy Restoration is a full-service restoration contractor. We're serving the Portland metro market since 1950. We're a third-generation, family-owned business that focuses on restoration only. We do not do new construction or remodeling. Kennedy Restoration has purchased a non-traditional franchise called 1-800-BOARD-UP. 1-800-BOARD-UP does not chase fires, but works with the fire departments to help the victim and secure the structure if needed, along with other services. We only respond when called directly by the fire department. This service hopefully allows the victim time to deal logically instead of being preyed upon emotionally by the fire chasers. We try and educate the victim on what to do or what may happen after the fire is out. Most chasers use fear and emotion to get the victim to sign a contract with them. They say things like, your insurance company sent us, or this isn't going to cost you anything, or a friend of yours sent us to help you, and many, many more. Then they present the victim with a highly inflated invoice for services, sometimes for services not even needed, and without regard for any policy limits the customer may have within their insurance policy. Insurance companies cannot stop fire chasers, as they are often not even aware of their policyholder's loss until a few hours after the fire event. We take our responsibility very seriously and have become increasingly frustrated with what is happening out there. We therefore fully endorse Senate Bill 574 as it is currently written. Mandating a proper life through the CCB is a positive step towards protecting the consumers currently being taken advantage of by unlicensed predatory entities. We very much appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee. Welcome any further chances to do so. Respectfully, Matthew Steinle.
Thank you, sir. Is there any questions? We appreciate you calling in and sharing that perspective. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Bye now.
Bye now.
All right, that's all I have signed up on this bill. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 574. Do we have all the paperwork?
We do. You got some special ones.
And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 574. The chair moves the dash one amendment, which modifies the effective date to July 1st, 2017. Discussion on that motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Okay, the dash one amendments are adopted. The chair moves the Senate Bill 574 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? Senate Bill 574 as amended by the dash ones is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. We'll ask the two senators, Olson and Shields, to carry. Okay, we'll close on 574. We will now, let's go up to the top. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 533. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 533 permits motorcycle driver to proceed at stoplight under certain conditions, including the traffic control device shows a steady red signal, traffic control device controlled by a vehicle detection device, driver comes to a complete stop and waits for the traffic control device to complete one full cycle, and the device fails to detect the presence of the motorcycle and change to a green signal. We do have a dash one amendment. This permits bicyclists to proceed at stoplight under certain conditions. There is no fiscal impact, and there is no revenue impact.
Okay. Let's see here. I've got Crystal Berry and Paula Leslie. You want to come up together? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing this bill today. For the record, my name is Paula Leslie, Executive Director for Bike Pack of Oregon, Inc. Bike Pack of Oregon represents Abate of Oregon as well as Oregon's motorcycle riders. We are working closely with the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety to further our mission statement advocating motorcycle awareness, safety, education, and liberty, while working proactively to safely share the road with other modes of traffic. Bike Pack of Oregon has identified dead red lights to be particularly concerning among most motorcycle riders and bicycle riders, and this is why we're bringing forward Senate Bill 533, which would allow a motorcycle rider or bicycle rider to proceed through a red light should that light not sense that they're there. Dead red lights are basically the kind that are at a censored light system. There are many different kinds of light sensors. There's traffic camera sensors. There's also sensors using infrared beams, but the kind that we're particularly concerned about today are the kind that are inlaid in the pavement itself that have to sense a vehicle being there. And motorcycle riders and bicyclists are having a hard time getting those lights to change. And this would allow the rider to safely proceed through the light after the light system has gone through one complete cycle if they can do so safely. So that is the problem, and Senate Bill 533 would benefit in that this puts the law back in the hands of the rider and allows them to be in charge of their own safety. Secondly, we won't have to sit and wait for a car to come up behind us to activate the light. And thirdly, riders will not be ticketed if reasonable care was taken. And there are 16 other states that have a similar law as this one, and Washington was the last state to pass a law. We have a motorcycle rider here that can tell you how her safety it definitely became a safety issue with her being stopped at a light that wouldn't change for her.
Thank you, committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Berry. I'm a motorcyclist living down in Eugene, Oregon, and I just want to speak in favor of this, and there have been times I've been at this type of light with the sensor. You know, you try to ride right over the middle of it, ride to the side, you know, just try a bunch of different things. I've had to, in the past, I've waited for cycles to go through, cars get behind you, I've had to pull into the crosswalk, full face helmet on, turn around to the people behind me in the car, try to wave them forward. They can't, you know, see my face very well or see what I'm doing. I'm trying to signal, hey, this won't pick me up. Please come forward. And I'm already, you know, in the crosswalk, almost into the intersection at that point anyway, just to get the light triggered by a car behind me. I've also been honked at. I've been slowly, luckily, bumped into by a car. And if you've been on a motorcycle yourself, it's very unnerving and very, very unsettling. It's a great way to get knocked over, which has not happened. But it's frustrating to the cars behind you. It's difficult as a rider to communicate that. And actually, interestingly, I was surprised at first to see this come up, because in the basic rider training that we take to get our motorcycle endorsement, we are taught that it is okay to wait through, they say, three cycles and then proceed. So we're already taught that that's the proper thing to do. And so anyway, at a busy intersection, you know, they have sensors at the stop line, and then they have them a little bit further back, too, so they can sense if there's a line of cars. But at a less busy intersection, which you could safely proceed through a red light with no traffic coming, they don't necessarily have those sensors further back because there aren't cars further back, and you just sit there. I also have a friend who has been cited for going through a red light. You know, you can easily say, well, how do you know how many cycles you were sitting there through? I think one cycle is reasonable. We don't want to get hit. We're not going to go out there and run through those red lights. You know, navigating an intersection on a green light is dangerous enough sometimes. So we know to be cautious. I do recognize this as public safety. I am also a registered nurse and a mother who loves being able to come home from my ride. And I encourage you to be supportive of this because it's a good thing.
So just to be clear, the point is you stop at the red light.
You do stop. You pull up, you stop, you're at your intersection, you're following the laws, you wait. The other lights turn green. You wait. The other lights turn green again. And yours just doesn't. It doesn't detect that anybody is there. So on intersections, the loop type of intersections, and you can usually see where they are. They've got a cutout of the pavement with the tar seal around it where the loop's been put in. I don't know that much about it. My understanding is that they're magnetic and, you know, they detect the iron. It's not a weight thing. There's just not... I just don't have the mass and the presence there on my motorcycle to trigger those. So,
other questions? Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I don't ride a motorcycle, but I ride a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had this happen to me on my bicycle that the light just doesn't change. And so I watch it, watch the other lights, and watch, make sure the traffic's clear and the lights have gone, and then I go. And maybe that's illegal, I don't know, but otherwise you're sitting there all day.
It is.
So I can fully understand the reason. Does this apply to bicycles as well as motorcycles?
We have an amendment.
I believe they've amended it to include bicyclists.
There's an amendment that does that?
The bill does not now, but there is an amendment.
Okay. Well, if it has bicycles in it, too, I'll support it.
All right.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Senator Monroe, if I may, this bill was intended to originally add bicycles to the list because while we've been working with other modes of transportation and trying to safely share the road, we found that bicyclists also have this concern, and it's widespread among almost all of motorcycle riders, and almost every bicyclist that we've talked to have had the same issue. And so we would support the bicycle community being added to this bill.
I think we're going to hear about that shortly. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I'm not a bicycle rider in traffic, nor am I a motorcycle rider, but I have been behind motorcycles who set
through. Was that you honking?
That was me, but I didn't honk at you.
Okay.
But you know, I fully support this bill. So.
Okay.
Thank
Anybody
you.
Else? Senator Gerard.
Yeah, the one concern I have is for photo ticketing of red
photo
lights.
Radar.
Well, yeah, for red lights. Do you have a way that we could monitor who's doing it illegally and who's not? Because that's going to kind of throw a crimp into that little venue.
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, what we've found is that the camera sensors are not as much of an issue as just the sensors that are only on the ground. And
I'm talking about motorbikes that run red lights. And so it seems to me like if you had a motorbike that was running a red light and it gets picked up and gets a ticket for running the red light, that the defense is, hey, the light wasn't working sort of thing. And does that make any sense to you?
Yes, Senator Gerard, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, the Oregon State Patrol has mentioned this as well and have found that they will ticket riders who they notice that if they're sitting there doing patrol, they will ticket them if they fail to stop and wait at the light. But this bill is meant to have the rider wait for one full cycle, and there are many light systems that are timed where this would not be an issue, and so we would support the State Patrol ticketing those riders who don't bother to stop for those lights.
Makes it tougher.
It does make it hard to enforce.
Okay, anything else? Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
And let's see, Jonathan. Mr. Bicycle.
I've been called a lot worse, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. Chair Beyer, my name is Jonathan Manton, here on behalf of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Our mission is to create healthy, sustainable communities by making bicycling safe, convenient, and accessible. And really, I just wanted to say thank you. We agree with the testimony that's been aired thus far. Thank you to Paula, and thank you for your staff upstairs for getting work on an amendment done so fast. Heidi and Elsie as well was really great to work with to getting the Dash Ones put together so that we could have the bicyclists included in this bill.
I don't have much to say. Remember that they're supposed to stop, too.
Yes, yes. And I'll just add, like, the BTA, part of our work is to promote safety and enforce the laws, and this is something that will help us do that. We want to be the voice of responsible cyclists, and we are, and this is a bill that furthers that aim.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Thank you. All right, Amy.
We should just camp there.
And the gospel from DMV.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation today representing our safety division. Happy to be here to talk about Senate Bill 533 and the Dash 1 Amendment. Fundamentally, the purpose of traffic engineering and traffic laws is basically to keep people and their vehicles out of the same space. And part of the way you do that is to make things as predictable as possible so people can anticipate what others are going to do. The bill essentially adds some level of a little bit less predictability into the mix. As one of the earlier witnesses testified, the Team Oregon program, the mandatory training program, does educate folks on how to position their bike over those traffic loops, so they should be sensed. If there's ever a case where that is malfunctioning or miscalibrated, the most important thing is to get that reported to the local jurisdiction so that it can be fixed. Failure of traffic signals to cycle is a top priority on any list of things to be fixed immediately within hours when that's reported, because it's a safety concern. I'm not sure about the other item mentioned about that Team Oregon recommends waiting 3 cycles and then to go. That is new information to me, and I'm going to be checking into that, so I can't confirm or deny that that's accurate. But basically, there's a concern that you're going to be putting people in a little less predictable situation. It's going to be a little less safe, and so we would ask the committee to consider that fact.
I appreciate that, Amy. I have noticed the other side, though. I mean, there I have some reluctance on this, but the reality with short resources, a lot of those lights don't get fixed. And this is probably in the low traffic, lower priority areas, would be my guess. Most of the heavy intersections seem, at least my observation, is they've gone to the camera focus system rather than the attention plates. So I get it.
Understood.
The questions of Amy? Seeing them. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Was there anybody else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 533? Going once, twice? Doesn't seem like it. So we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 533. The chair moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 533, which adds bicycles. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there opposition to the motion? There is none. The Dash 3s are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill 533 as amended by the Dash 1s. Discussion on that motion. Senator Girard.
Yeah, there's just one part of it, and it talks about how you have to have it cycle through the green light. And there's a comment that says the driver proceeds through the intersection with caution. I don't know if that's strong enough language. Obviously, you got to wait for all the other traffic, so... That little verbiage might want to be changed in the House, but other than that, I'm all for it.
Okay. Others? I do have some reservations about this. We may be adding some risk, but I think in weighing it, I've seen this enough myself, particularly with bicycles, that it probably makes some sense. We want to get away from the situation where cars are bumping into the back of motorcycles or blaring their horns. So hopefully this will not be a bad bill. So opposition to this motion? Seeing none, Senate Bill 533, as amended by the Dash Ones, is passed to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there anybody want to carry it?
I think Senator Monroe does.
Monroe, you want to carry it?
I will carry it.
Wants to carry. Okay. So we'll close on 533. And let's see, where are we down to? We're down to 578. Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 578. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 578 permits insurer under certain conditions to post insurance policy and endorsements on insurer's website in lieu of mailing or delivering insurance policy endorsements to insured. There is no amendment, and there is no revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact.
Mr. Barrels, Mr. Miller, you want to come up together?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Tom Barrows, representing Progressive Insurance, here in favor of Senate Bill 578, which would allow insurance companies, if they chose to create a program, to post the basic information of a policy online rather than mail a book like often happens now. And we've got studies that show that a lot of people just throw them in the recycling or the garbage and then don't have it when they need it. So this would offer that opportunity for those companies that wanted to participate. If they did want to participate and you signed up for, say, auto insurance, you would still get your basic information that's personal to you. The declaration page would be mailed to you, and included with that would be a reference to where you could go view the rest of the information. Or if you wanted a hard copy, one would be mailed to you at no cost. So folks that still want to get the hard copy and keep it, that's still an option and would not cost them anything. After the policy is done, it would the company would be required to archive that information for 5 years beyond that. That's kind of the basic of the bill.
Now, 5 years or as long as the policy is in effect?
After the policy is no longer in effect, they would still have to. While it's in effect, they've got to maintain that and then have it for another 5 years to make sure that.
How about changes?
Changes to the policy,
changes
Mr.
to
Chair?
The policy.
I presume that any changes would have to be the mail would continue. There would be changes represented on the declaration page. This is the boilerplate policy language. And if changes are made on there, it would probably be a separate page on the website that would be offered.
It's affectionately referred to as the small print.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Assurers Association in support of Senate Bill 578. And, just a few comments on the bill. You know, there is an increasing desire from our customers to go paperless. I know when I started in this building, Tom was around, a lot of you were around in this building, everything was paper. And we've gone now to OLIS, and most of the offices are now paperless. And so, except Senator Gerard.
There are some
but there is an increasing desire, and as Tom indicated, all this is done by mail, and Oregon has already been an innovator. And to answer one of your questions, if you recall, in 2014, this legislature approved a bill allowing insurance to conduct all their policy holders notifications online. So if you choose, again, it was voluntary, which more and more people, the majority of people are going this route, you can receive your applications, your policy information, your notices, your billing statements, all online, electronic notification. And so to answer your question, Senator Beyer, on the previous question, if there is changes, a lot of that stuff can be done electronically, and that's still, under this bill, the policy would be posted on the web for your convenience. And so also in Oregon, we passed legislation allowing drivers to show their proof of insurance on their smartphone. So, but again, that was, you know, prior to that option where you had to have that piece of paper in your car. If you're pulled over, you can actually pull it up on your smartphone, and that is legal now in Oregon. This just is, I think, the kind of concludes the whole e-commerce discussion that we have been having and allows this web posting of your policies. Again, you will receive that deck page, which is that front page policy summary of all of your coverage. And again, as you said, Senator Beyer, the fine print is always available on the web for your availability. Now, again, you know, it's not a publicly available website. It's specific to your policy. Again, the bill is voluntary and asking for the support of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? No questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 578? Does the department have any concerns? No concerns. Okay, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 578. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 578. Chair moves Senate Bill 578 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. You looking to carry this bill?
I will.
Yeah. Well, okay. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? No opposition? Senate Bill 578 is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Senator Thompson wishes to carry. So we'll close on 578. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 582. James.
Senate Bill 582 provides that credit union may pay directors and supervisory committee members of the credit union reasonable compensation for directors or committee member services, removes requirement to open a share account as a condition of membership, allows persons with the field of membership to become member based upon the credit relationship or on payment of a membership fee, repeals requirement that any credit union that provides membership to employees of State of Oregon include foster parents in its field of membership, modifies the definition of immediate family for membership eligibility to include foster parents and legally appointed guardians, removes requirement for credit union to apply and pay fee to Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to open new branches. We do have a -1 amendment. It adds a 30-day notification requirement to Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services for opening new branches. There is no revenue or fiscal impacts.
Pam, come on up along with Mr. Soggins and Burgess. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your glasses today.
I know. This is my 21st year in the building, so these are added to my. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. Thank you for the time today to talk about Senate Bill 582. This is a bill that we've been working on for the past year, and our other folks will talk a little bit more about the process and in detail. I just want to say that we are really proud in Oregon to have a robust Oregon credit union community that provides comprehensive financial services to all Oregonians in our not-for-profit cooperative structure. We have about 41.7% of Oregonians who are members of credit unions, and they come from all walks of life, from cattle ranchers in Central Oregon to mill workers in the Willamette Valley, fishermen on the Oregon coast to high-tech workers around the state. So with our 1.63 million members, Oregon credit unions provide high-quality financial services to Oregonians and are in every community in the state and every legislative district. Our success has been in large part by our strong charter, and that's really why we're here today. Every 2 years, we come to you and review the Oregon Credit Union Act financial services marketplace changes quickly, and we feel like we need to have a charter updated every couple years to make sure we're providing the highest quality
Fidelity Financial Services to Oregonians. So I provided full testimony about Oregon credit unions, and you have that, and I'm not going to go into that. I've met with all of you. And to be brief, I'll turn it over to these guys to talk about the process and the bill. Thank you.
Pam, this, yes. this only relates to opening an office within an established service territory, right?
This Senator Beyer, this bill has four technical changes to the Oregon Credit Union Act, and one of those are what you implement.
I'm speaking to that one. But
yes,
yeah.
Yes, and we'll go into that. Thank you. Scott, yeah.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Scott Burgess, and I'm the president and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union. My role today, as Pam alluded to, is to talk a little bit about the process that credit unions have gone through as we have prepared for the components that are in this bill. First, if I could just take a moment to tell you a little bit about Rivermark. We serve approximately 70,000 members across the state of Oregon. We serve 11 counties across Oregon. And as a community chartered credit union, we serve members all the way from Salem up to the Portland metropolitan area, where the bulk of our members are. We also serve members in the Dalles, where we have a significant presence in the Dalles, and we also have the only financial institution in Maupin. We were founded in 1951 as Safeway Credit Union, and we changed our name to Rivermark Community Credit Union in 2004. Since 2010, I've had the privilege of serving as the chair of the State Issues Subcommittee of the Northwest Credit Union Association. And as a State Issues Chair, I want to talk about the process, as I mentioned, of which credit unions, state chartered credit unions across the state of Oregon, have undertaken to develop legislative concepts that are ultimately a part of this bill. State chartered credit unions come together, as Pam mentioned, every 2 years to review the Oregon Credit Union Act for recommended updates and changes, and we recognize, as again as Pam alluded to, that we're constantly in a changing financial landscape, changing consumer behaviors. Our members are dealing with a different economic well-being on a fairly consistent basis. So it's important that Oregon credit unions have laws that evolve with the changing needs. And clearly, we are operating in a fluid and operating environment. So it's important that the laws do change to support that. Credit union leaders from across the state have met several times over the course of this past year, and we've reviewed the law. We sit down and we go through the statutes, and we ask ourselves, what is it that we need to best serve our members? Because we are member-owned, it's very important that we're able to best serve our members. We want to be more efficient in the way we provide services to them as well. So the bill has been reviewed, supported by credit unions across the state. And we've worked very closely with our association, and it's very important to us as well in the process that we talk with other stakeholders, namely our regulator, DCBS, so that they understand why we're asking for these changes. So that's really the process. Happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley, Wada, Witt in Portland. We're the counsel for the Northwest Credit Union Association and also for many of the individual credit unions in Oregon and Washington. This bill is not a long bill. It doesn't make a lot of changes, but credit unions in Oregon believe these changes are important to preserve and strengthen the credit union charter in Oregon. And I'll briefly outline what the changes are and then be happy to answer any questions. The first change relates to the process for establishing a new branch, and that process currently requires submitting an application to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and then the department approves or denies or requests more information. The bill would convert that process into one of submitting a notice to the department, and then the department has an opportunity to ask questions or object, notify the credit union of any concerns that it may have, but rather than submitting a formal application, it simply converts it to a notice. The Dash 1 amendments that I believe you have would change, would add a 30-day advance requirement to that notice process. The second change is really a technical change, and it moves a provision that has been in the Act for years, and nobody can quite remember how or why it got there, but it requires credit unions that have state employees in their membership to include foster parents of children who are within the field of membership as also eligible within the field of membership. It's off in its own separate place in the Credit Union Act, and this bill would change that, move it to the section on field of membership with the other field of membership provisions, and it would also make it apply to all credit unions and not just those with state employees in their fields of membership. Third change relates to compensation of directors and supervisory committee members. This is, again, not a large change in terms of verbiage, but it's one that credit unions see as important. Currently, the Credit Union Act prohibits compensating directors and supervisory committee members. They are all volunteers currently. This would make a change that's been made in a number of other states to permit credit unions, wouldn't require credit unions to do so, but it would permit credit unions to make the choice to compensate their directors and supervisory committee members. And credit unions will make the determination of what would constitute reasonable compensation for that work. We are in a time of extraordinary pressure on the financial services industry, and that includes credit unions. The fact that they are nonprofit cooperatives does not exclude or exempt them from the pressures that they face and the pressures that their directors and supervisory committee members face. This is a job. It's not a job, obviously, but it is a position that is increasingly requiring more time, more expertise. There's more pressure from the regulators on directors. There are more regulations that are requiring the board to specifically oversee certain areas of the credit union and operational detail that is heretofore unknown. And there's also increased liability exposure for directors. And it's important for credit unions to be able to attract and retain competent, qualified, engaged, and energetic folks to serve in that capacity. And so this would allow credit unions to provide at least some form of compensation, even if it's only a small stipend to compensate for the lost time in other areas. And then last change is, again, what I would consider sort of a technical change, but it's one that will make things operationally easier for a number of credit unions. Currently, in order to be a credit union member, you not only have to be within the field of membership, the Act also requires that you establish a share account with the credit union in a minimum amount that's set by the credit union. That's usually $5 or $10, sometimes $25, depending on the credit union. This would do away with that requirement and let credit unions set for themselves what their minimum requirements to join the credit union are in terms of establishing a share relationship or a deposit relationship or a loan relationship. The reason I consider this an operational change more than anything else is for two reasons. One is you still have to be within the field of membership in order to join the credit union. This doesn't change that in any way, shape, or form. And the second is that credit unions operationally are sometimes face challenges with this requirement. There are a lot of members that want to have a relationship with the credit union that's just a loan relationship. They may want a credit card or they want to get a car loan from a credit union, but they don't want to have a deposit account there or a share account there. And those people are now required to have this minimum $5 or $10 share account in order just to get the loan. And the other side of that coin is that it's expensive for the credit unions to maintain those accounts, provide statements, do the data processing and all of that. And if we do away with that requirement, then persons who are within the field of membership of the credit union can establish a relationship as required by the credit union, pay a membership fee, do whatever else the board determines are the requirements to join the credit union. But that would be how it would work. It wouldn't be tied to this having a share account. The other thing, and again, very technical in nature, is we have, as long as I can remember, in the Oregon Credit Union Act, authorized state chartered credit unions to have both deposit accounts and share accounts. Deposit accounts from an accounting perspective, are a liability, and they earn interest while share accounts pay dividends. That's a small difference, but in order to be a member of the credit union, the way the act is written, you have to establish a share account. So if this is a credit union that has decided to have deposit accounts instead of share accounts, they still have to keep this one little membership account as a share form of account rather than a deposit form of account. They refer to earnings on that account as dividends rather than interest. All the other operational and technical differences between shares and deposits, this would allow credit unions to avoid having that that dichotomy if they've chosen to offer deposit accounts. So that's a brief summary of the changes. I have more detailed information in my testimony. I would apologize. I have one error in my testimony. At the end, I say it's Section 4 that does the share account requirement change, and that's actually Section 2. That was a misnumbering on my part.
Questions?
I guess I have.
Senator?
So can you explain to me the part with regard to application and fees? So right now you guys pay $300 to DCBS to do what? If you're going to make a new, put up a new credit union somewhere.
Branch.
You go a new branch, you go through a process.
Yes.
So, right? And you're asking to waive that.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, that is correct. We're asking to change that from a requirement to submit an application and pay the $500 fee. I believe it's $500.
Okay.
And instead turn that into a notice requirement. So we still have to tell the DCBS what is happening.
But you don't have to pay the $500 or the $300?
That is correct.
Do banks get, do they have to do that? I mean, you guys have to do it now. Banks have to do it now.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, as the statutes are currently written, banks do have this same requirement that credit unions do.
Okay.
I understand that they would be interested in making this same change and certainly encourage them to do so.
So does follow? Does this take time from the agency to do these? Or, I mean, we're not going to pay them anymore, so that really we're saying that. So how I've been on natural resources, ways and means. I've been on now I'm on the education sub. I've never had anybody come in and ask to do away completely with a fee. So this is the first time I've ever heard it.
Chair Beyer,
who's going to pay for that service?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, credit unions currently pay for DCBS services through the totality of the fees that they are charged, not just through this application fee, and the payment for this process would be absorbed in the overall fees that credit unions pay for being regulated by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So that will, you know, this will factor into the budgeting process in some small sense, but the reality, I believe, is this is not a significant source of revenue for the department, and it's probably not matched very closely to the amount of time that it takes to review one application versus another application, and the cost for administering the Credit Union Act by DCBS will continue to be paid for by credit unions.
Okay. We're going to hear from the agency.
Yep, they're up next.
Okay. And I guess I have I don't really understand this credit unions, banks. It's a big topic, not big topic, but I don't understand this industry that well. So the credit unions, all I ever hear is, well, credit unions are the way they are. They don't have to pay taxes. Pay taxes on what? Your the end profit, the amount you have in the bank. And what do banks pay taxes on?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, that is a fabulous question, and the answer is banks pay taxes on their profits like any other business.
Okay.
They earn net income, which ultimately is distributed to the shareholders, the owners of the bank.
Okay.
Credit unions are not-for-profit organizations, and so credit unions retain earnings in order to build capital to be safe and sound, but they don't that pay taxes on profit because their profits are returned to the members of the credit union in a cooperative organization in the form of either lower interest on loans or higher dividends on share and deposit accounts.
Like your growers cooperative.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Beyer, Senator Thompson, I was just going to comment, just like any other not-for-profit cooperative, we pay all other taxes, property taxes, employment taxes, every other tax, but because there is no profit, we don't pay that tax.
So follow-up. I don't know how, banks started, credit unions started, but when you sit down every couple of years and you go through your charter and you look at it, so some of the things you're changing, are those some of the reasons that credit unions were formed and allowed to happen? And if you go over, what line can you get to when all of a sudden you're really not what you were chartered to be from the very beginning? Is there such a thing?
Senator Beyer, Senator Thompson, I don't know if you're referring to the testimony you received from the bankers, because no. I just saw that when we walked in today, or I would have had broader responses to that. But I will say that this is my 21st year representing credit unions, and when every single issue that we have raised through the years, we have received arguments that you're no longer a credit union. Some of you may recall, we had a big debate on public deposits. Should credit unions receive public funds? And that was several years ago. Credit unions are now accepting public funds. And I heard over and over that if we receive public funds, we will no longer be credit unions. Credit unions will always be not-for-profit financial cooperatives. Right. When Congress created credit unions, they didn't say you could only be a little tiny small credit unions that only do this.
Yeah.
We were created to be full-service financial institutions. Our structure does not change, regardless of the products and services we offer. For example, on the director compensation piece, other cooperatives, have compensation for their directors. Several states do have director compensation for credit unions. We're still going to be credit unions. We're just looking at moving into this century for providing financial services for credit unions in Oregon. Credit unions in Oregon have been very strong. We've been pillars of our communities during the financial downturn. We were there for our members. We were refinancing loans. People come in from other financial institutions that couldn't get refinancing. And I know that argument. I've heard it in my 20-plus years that you are no longer credit unions because you do this or you do this. This bill is nothing out of the ordinary for us. It's things that we go and update every 2 years. So I would strongly disagree that because of any of the things in Senate Bill 582, we are no longer credit unions.
That wasn't the argument I made.
The question you asked?
The question I asked. So that was a little defensive. The question I asked was, when you sit down and review this every 2 years like you said you did, I don't know the history of credit unions, history of banks, what all that is, but is there something out there that says you're a credit union if you're this way, you're a bank if you do that way, credit unions, community banks, small town, big banks, what makes up all that? And is there something like in the credit union that says you're a credit union because you can do this? Because, we get new ideas. You sit down every 2 years. How can we do it better? Is there a line or anything out there? Or it's just like you said when you replied, you're always it's always evolving.
I apologize, Senator.
That was, you took that really defensive.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, I would offer
that knowing more than I do.
The answer to that question is actually contained in the Credit Union Act itself, in 723006, and it says a credit union in Oregon, an Oregon State Chartered Credit Union, is a cooperative nonprofit association incorporated under the laws of this state for the purposes of encouraging thrift among its members, creating a source of credit at fair and reasonable rates of interest, and providing an opportunity for members to use and control their own money in order to improve their economic and social condition. And if we propose moving credit unions away from that purpose and that structure, then that would probably be moving credit unions out of the realm of what a credit union is in Oregon. I have not, in as many years as Pam has been here more, ever heard any credit union propose anything like that. They are still and will continue to be nonprofit cooperative associations organized and operating for the benefit of their members and the state of Oregon.
Yeah, and that's what I was wondering, if when you make every 2 years when you do your, you know, how can we improve ourselves? So that's kind of what, that's what you look at to make sure you stay in those guidelines. That's all I asked you. Okay. Thanks.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, if I can just add my thoughts to it, scare the attorney here, because I just want to say that, you know, from a practical standpoint, what we would do that would cause us to go over that line is to transfer ownership of the credit union to outside stockholders, essentially. And you know, as a cooperative owned and governed by our members, everything that we do is for the members. So if we transfer that outside of the membership to outside stockholders, that would be something that I would consider crossing the line. And our attorney can jump in and correct me.
Thanks.
And in fact, some across the nation, some credit unions have converted to banks. Mm-hmm. And then they have to pay all the taxes. Then.
Okay.
Other questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now from the regulators, Mr. Tapman and Mr. Blackwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thompson wants to know about what happens if you lose $500.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and next to me is Richard Blackwell. Mr. Blackwell is our policy analyst that's been working with the Northwest Credit Union Association on this matter. We regulate both banks and credit unions, as well as 12 other programs of financial services, so we have a broad spectrum of things that we do. Know this, first of all, each one of those programs we regulate, they're all within its own separate funding silo. Credit union money goes to regulate credit unions. Bank money goes to regulate banks. So we're very careful about that, and we spend an inordinate amount of time looking at the financials and trying to make sure we've got that just right. And so we're very mindful of that issue. We have talked with the Northwest Credit Union Association about their bill here. Mr. Blackwell's worked with them pretty closely, and as you've mentioned, there's a dash one to this. As you heard from Mr. Scoggins earlier, there's essentially three parts to this. The one I want to focus on is the first one, and that is the issue that just came up with Senator Thompson around the proposal to move away from an application process to a notice process. Initially, it was a notice process that we would receive notice and it took effect immediately. We felt like that's not sufficient, and we asked the Northwest Credit Union Association to look at an amendment, and they did work with us on this so that it gave us a period of time to look at and address concerns. The difference between an application and a notice is there's a very a formal process for the application. A lot of information is collected, financial information, demographic information, maybe a review of what other credit unions have branches in the area and so forth. A lot of that is unnecessary in this day and age. That information is available to us. We are in contact with the credit union long before that 30-day window would begin. They've been talking to us for months in advance as they're looking at opening up a branch in a new area. So we're fully aware of what they're doing. We've probably gone in and done an examination in that interim period of time to determine if they're of sufficient safety and soundness to withstand the capital expenditure of opening that additional branch. So what I don't want the committee to walk away from is thinking there will be an abdication of review on our part to make a determination. What this does is streamlines the process to some degree. The request came that by the way, as Senator Thompson pointed out, it was a $300 fee for one and $500 for the other, hence the confusion. The $300 fee could add up over a period of time. In the last 5 years, we've had 21 applications, so $6,000 over the last 5 years, so roughly $1,000 a year. That's money we could all benefit from, but it's not a significant amount of money to speak of. And so we think that this is a request from the industry. We're just letting it go in front of the agent of the committee. We can accept that without having to have that fee. I think that's based on the fact that the review process is more streamlined. There will be a review still, but it'll be more streamlined, less processing of paper and so forth. So we feel like we can live within that. We are very mindful that we've got two competing industries between banks and credit unions. They're very aware of what one another are doing. And boy, if one didn't get the same slice of pie as the other, there's a real concern sometimes. So we keep that firmly in mind. And in fact, when I talked with the Credit Union Association, I expressed my concerns that we should be doing this in parallel. Well, timing's always of an issue. I do want this committee to know that we are working with the Oregon Bankers Association. We are setting up a task force this spring to look at in toto overall how we regulate banking in Oregon. And as a part of that, we're going to be looking at how we charge fees in general. I'd much rather address the issue of fees as a complete holistic approach rather than a piecemeal one. So although we are equally supportive of banks coming forward with something like that, I've expressed to the Oregon Bankers Association our desire to do this within that task force and address this at a later date for banks. So it's not that we're going to have one for credit unions and one for banks. I think down the road we will be addressing this to try and continue to have parity where parity makes sense. But I think within the context of a broader task force review of all fees, it makes sense to allow the process to go forward, and then we can come back next year, presumably in 2 years' time. I will say this, though, that we do get a lot more branch applications on the banking side than we do in the credit union side, and the process requires two agencies to review that as well. So the FDIC, the Federal Depository Insurance Corporation, reviews branch applications. There's no corresponding process like that with credit unions. So that addresses the first section. The second one, when I first heard the proposal that they wanted to take away the share requirements for members, I was aghast. I said, that is the way that credit unions are recognized. Everyone has a share. That share represents the right to vote. Well, it turns out I was misunderstanding the process. That's just one indicia of membership. But the membership process continues whether you get in there and get a loan or whether you go in and buy a share to become a member. You still have to qualify for membership. And second of all, you still get the one vote as long as you're receiving the services and benefits. So the fact that you got a loan rather than you have a share doesn't eliminate your right to vote. And that was my big concern, was I wanted to make sure that all credit union members that are participating in the credit union had the right to vote. And I've been assured that will continue, so section two doesn't concern me that much. The third issue is the one around the question of compensation and the one compensation for board members. Now, you've received the materials from the Oregon Bankers Association, and what you see is that our credit unions, some of them in Oregon, are quite large. They've been very successful, and they're very large. They have a equally complex responsibility as board members as a bank board member does. We understand the need to get people that are highly qualified, and in this busy era, that's more of a challenge. I asked Rick, Mr. Blackwell here, to do some research, and we found out that there's 13 or 14 other states that allow for compensation already for board members of credit unions. So this would not be something that's going off in a new direction. Second of all, as Mr. Scoggins pointed out, this is optional. And the third point I want to make is the language in their reasonable compensation is just an invitation for rulemaking. You can be assured that we are going to go through the rulemaking process to determine what is reasonable. And reasonable, the state of Washington recently did that. It was a fairly comprehensive process. But at a minimum, we're going to look at the nature of the credit union, the size of the credit union, the nature of the compensation that's being proposed, and the ability to handle that, and to ensure that members of the credit union are aware that they're moving in the direction of compensating their board of director members. So we will engage in rulemaking should this committee and ultimately the legislature make the policy decision that that's the direction they want to head in.
So with respect to that, would you likely require in your rules that any compensation be approved by the members?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, At least at a minimum, I would expect that they approve that they will be paying compensation. I would hope that the credit union, in an effort to be transparent, would spell out how that compensation would be structured. It would be subject to us saying that's reasonable, and then whether they had the membership vote on it or not, I'm not sure. But my first impression is that's a good idea.
Yeah, I guess that, again, it's one of the distinctions between banks, where usually they're shareholders, their board of directors are usually shareholders, as opposed to credit unions where they're members.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a subtle distinction there that my inclination first is, having served on a large credit union for a few years as a director, there's a whole lot of complexity there that it makes some sense that they would get compensation in some way. I mean, the federal rules that are coming down, let alone the state, require an awful lot of training and a huge liability and fiduciary responsibilities. So that makes some sense to me. On the other hand, I think it is a distinction, and most of the credit unions see as a voluntary effort to do that. So I would feel more comfortable. I'm not going to suggest we put it in statute, but as you think about it, if this goes forward, I like the idea that that would be subject to the vote of the membership, which could easily be done annually at their annual meetings.
Senator Beyer, as I said, my first impression is I like the idea as well. Mr. Blackwell will no doubt be in charge of the hearing. The rulemaking process. Ours is a very engaged process where we have a rulemaking advisory committee from the outset, and so this is not something that the agency decides. This is something we go through an extended process on. So I'm sure we will take notes back at the office. I'm sure somebody's watching this right now, and we will incorporate that into the process, as well as Northwest Credit Union Association will probably be supportive of that too.
Senator Rice?
Yeah, the question I have, when they do the site application now, what actually do you review? They have a fiduciary responsibility, and so they've kind of already done a major part of the work. So I'm just trying to figure out what DCBS actually does.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, what we do when it's an application is we're going to take a look at, one, do we have an overabundance of branches in a particular area? Salem was a hotbed of credit union branches about 5-6 years ago, and we proceeded to watch credit union branches disappear because they overbuilt, if you will, in the area. So that's one thing we'd look at. Two, and more importantly, is we take a look at their safety and soundness, their financial ability to handle both the build-out but also sustain that, because the proposition of opening a branch typically is a losing financial proposition at the outset. So do they have the capital reserves or the capital set aside to do that? So third, we'll take a look at the overall condition of the credit union itself. If a credit union, and at this point our credit unions are in strong shape, we have something I'm sure you're familiar with, CAMELS ratings, one being the best all the way down to five. If somebody's less than satisfactory, a three or below, we're going to have some reservations about their ability to take on these additional responsibilities. So through all this process, we're going to be looking at, as I said, their demographics. If they're of a particular field of membership, does that field have a presence in the area? If somebody's field of membership is related to lumber and timber, and they're doing this, say, down in an area where there is no timber and there isn't any industry supporting it, well, we'd have some real concerns. What is their ultimate goal there? So the process is, I think what you're driving at, Senator Girard, is that at this point, there's less and less to be reviewed in this day and age than there was. And so we feel like the process can be sped up.
Yeah, thank you. My concern is I want to see a free market. And so, you know, the very first statement that you made, that you think that it might be saturated already, that's not my concern, you know, because some credit union might go in and they just provide a better service, mm-hmm. and somebody has to leave. That's fine, you know, in a free market philosophy. So there's so many fiduciary laws right now that, you know, that they have to look out for their investors, that I don't see where, you know, providing a review process really accomplishes much. So, you know, I just tend to be very sympathetic, I guess, to their cause.
Remember, there is a distinction between the bank with investors and the credit union with members. I think what David is talking about is they are exercise some oversight to make sure that the members are not going to be injured by an overextension of capital expenditures.
Well, but that's a fiduciary responsibility.
Other boards, you're right.
Yeah.
I guess the real question is, with the proposed change from approval to review, is that going to change what you do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in reality, I don't think it'll change that significantly. We still have the ability to make it clear that we're not comfortable with them going forward. But the reality is, by the point they file anything formally with us, whether it's going to be the formal application or now the notice, we've had the conversations. And the process is pretty well worked through. It's now a formality of saying yes or no.
My observation is that they don't do anything until they've sat down and talked with your staff a lot beforehand.
That's correct.
Yeah. Probably on both sides, actually.
Yeah, that's correct.
Senator.
Yeah, just for a further history lesson, I guess. So the credit unions want to start paying board members for their service. Whoever said they couldn't? And where did that start? I understand as they get bigger and bigger, they need better, you know.
But they're so faithful.
And I'm not arguing against it, but whoever said in the first place that they couldn't? And where did this? How has this law evolved over time?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, not to be flip, but this body said that the law was adopted to say you couldn't do so.
Our state, so it's not necessarily a federal thing.
Correct. That is correct. And that's the beauty of the process. I know that I'm, you know, going back to Civics 101, but the beauty of it is each state gets to set their own standards for something like this. So 14 states have decided this is okay. Other states have said, no, we don't like this. So I think this is, again, that's why I said this is a policy decision for this body. And I you heard the reasons for it, and I think they make some sense in the context of what you've heard.
We're all gone. Let me change it.
Any more questions? Gentlemen, any more questions? Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Sirs.
Yeah, thank you.
That's all I have signed up. Mr. Martinez, did you want to comment? Not today?
College,
anybody else wish to comment on this bill?
Of course not.
Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 582. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 582, and we have a dash one, correct?
We do.
Chair moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 582. A discussion on that? Senator?
In an abundance of caution, I'd like to declare a potential conflict. I have an offer from a credit union on my property, and I just want that on the record.
Well, I guess to that, I don't know, but I'm also a member of a couple of credit unions.
I think that's a pretty big class, Mr. Chair.
Pretty big class, probably goes beyond. Anybody else want to declare anything? Okay. Any further discussion on the amendment? Is there any opposition to the amendment? There is none. The dash ones are adopted. The chair moves Senate Bill 582 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion? No discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. Senate Bill 582, as amended by the dash ones, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. The chair will carry. Concludes on 582, and that takes us to the end of the agenda. Other things for the good of the order? There's none. We are adjourned. We are an efficient. We are adjourned. We are an efficient.